can, to, you know, up that and increase that pressure, that external pressure. Because that did, let's remember, play a part. That external pressure did play a part in actually bringing down the apartheid regime in South Africa. So, you know, we shouldn't be totally pessimistic about that, but we need to be realistic, I think, as Maroof has set out, but not actually give up on putting pressure, external pressure, to hasten that demise of the Zionist entity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chris Williamson, host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified, joining us from Derby in the UK, and also Laith Maroof, activist and political commentator from Beirut. Thanks for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight and sharing your thoughts and views with us. That brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa laqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wajtanibut taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله فلا وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate, and certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejectors. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not guide him who leads astray, nor shall they have any helpers. And they swear by Allah with the most energetic of their oath, Allah will not raise up him who dies. Yeah, is a promise binding on him, quite true, but most people do not know.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines, the number of Palestinians killed in Israeli airstrikes on Gaza since Tuesday rises to 25 as Palestinians fire a barrage of rockets toward Israel in response. Political tensions are rising in Pakistan as authorities arrest another close ally of former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who was detained this week. And Russia says it has achieved certain goals in its special military operation in Ukraine and has severely damaged Ukrainian military machine. Hello and welcome, everybody. The Al-Quds Brigades, which is the military arm of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, has confirmed the killing of three of its commanders in a late-night Israeli attack on Gaza. Head of Islamic Jihad's rocket-launching force, identified as Ali Ghali, and two other commanders died in the regime's airstrikes on Khan Yunis in the southern part of the coastal strip. 12 people were also injured. This is the third day of Israeli aggression on Gaza. Over 24 Palestinians have been killed so far, including several senior members of the Islamic Jihad movement, along with their family members. Palestinians have fired barrages of rockets on the occupied territories in response to the regime's assaults. The Israeli military claims that it has intercepted the rockets, but local media reported that a building was hit in the town of Sderot. A young Palestinian man has succumbed to wounds he sustained during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank, according to Palestinian medical sources. Aus Amin Hamamda was wounded when the regime's forces stormed the town of Rabatia, south of Jenin. The town has witnessed repeated Israeli assaults. On Wednesday, Israeli troops raided the town again and opened fire on locals, including on a vehicle that left two Palestinians dead and another wounded. They also broke into the homes and destroyed people's property. The regime has stepped up attacks across the occupied territories over the past months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year. In Pakistan, authorities have detained a close aide of former Prime Minister Imran Khan, who himself was arrested this week over a corruption case. Shah Mahmood Qureshi, who served as foreign minister under Khan's premiership, was detained amid growing political unrest across the country. In a statement, the Tehreek-e-Insaf party announced that Qureshi was taken to an undisclosed location. Earlier, two other senior leaders of the party, Asad Omar and Fawad Chaudhry, were arrested. Nationwide protests sparked after Khan was taken into custody. There were violent clashes between his supporters and police in several cities. The government has already given its approval to deploy troops to Punjab and Islamabad to restore peace. On Wednesday, cricketer-turned-politician Khan was remanded in police custody for 8 days.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was assisted by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery.
I might have been arrested in a false case when this message reaches all of you. The fundamental rights and democracy have been vanished from the country. Whatever happening at the moment is because of this imported government. So it's time for all of you to take to the streets for real freedom of the country.
The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife's name. The money should have been deposited in the National Treasury but went into a property which was registered under a trust.
Following the arrest, thousands of Khan's supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to protest their leader's detention. Clashes between police and protesters were also reported in all major cities and towns of the country.
The arrest of the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere will be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The European Union's foreign policy towards Africa is slated as the humanitarian situation in Sudan deteriorates. There have been calls in the European Parliament for the bloc to provide asylum to Sudanese refugees amid heavy clashes between rival military forces. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize a de facto military dictatorship because this is the arrangement that has served their financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticised for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda, and I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with the aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Russia says it has achieved certain goals in its special military operation in Ukraine, stressing that the operation will continue. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Russia has severely damaged the Ukrainian military machine. He, however, admitted that the operation in Ukraine is very difficult. Peskov said Ukraine's continued shelling of eastern parts of the country taken by Russia demonstrates the need to continue the operation to push back pro-Kiev forces. He added that Russia has launched countless missile strikes against military targets across Ukraine. Ukraine accuses Russia of hitting civilian targets, an accusation that Moscow denies. Following a quadrilateral meeting in Moscow, foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria, and Turkey have agreed to prepare a roadmap aimed to promote the relations between Damascus and Ankara. Marina Kortanova brings us more on that.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria, and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the U.N. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the U.N. humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same U.N. to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has urged Congress to raise the nation's debt ceiling to ward off an economic crisis. Janet Yellen called on legislators to increase the $31.4 trillion federal debt limit to avert an unprecedented default that would trigger a domestic as well as a global economic downturn. Her comments came after President Joe Biden warned that the country could slip into recession if lawmakers fail to raise the debt ceiling. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. If the limit is not raised by June the 1st deadline, the U.S. may default on its debt payments, which in turn could touch off a global economic catastrophe. Former U.S. President Donald Trump has doubled down on his claims about the 2020 presidential election in an exclusive interview with CNN. In a contentious 70-minute broadcast, Trump again refused to acknowledge that he lost to Joe Biden. He touted his false claims that the last election was rigged. He also declined to express regret over the Capitol attack when his supporters sought to prevent Congress from ratifying the election result. He repeated his plan to pardon individuals involved if voters return him to the White House in 2024. The CNN interview comes the day after a federal jury found Trump liable for sexually abusing and defaming a female columnist. The court ordered him to pay $5 million in damages to E. Jean Carroll. A two-day conference dubbed the New World Order Geometry has kicked off in the Iranian capital, Tehran, with the presence of attendees from dozens of countries. The event has been inspired by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution's call for universities and academics to play a key role in the creation of the New World Order that is emerging. Our correspondent Mahdi Abbasian reports.
An international conference on the New World Order Geometry has kicked off in Iran's capital, Tehran. Hosted by the University of National Defense, several high-ranking Iranian officials, as well as over 180 scholars, experts, and thinkers from 360 countries, including China, Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Oman, Syria, and Iraq, have attended this event. The two-day event discusses issues related to the formation of a new world order. Addressing the conference during the inauguration ceremony, Chief of Staff of Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri, said the Islamic Revolution has been one of the pillars to fight against the U.S. hegemonic agenda around the globe. Bagheri also said the U.S. attempts to rule over the world have ended in failure.
The governance of the world by hegemonic powers will fail. The signs of the decline of the U.S.'s power became obvious after the pullout of American forces from Iraq and Afghanistan, the remarkable reduction of U.S. troops in West Asia, as well as the U.S.'s confusion over the deployment of military forces to West Asia, south of China, and west of Europe.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf was also among the speakers of the opening ceremony. He said the world order is witnessing a change in favor of the oppressed, in which the Islamic Revolution plays a key role.
At the beginning of this meeting, when we all look at it fairly, we understand that if such opportunities are provided today for the humanity, the Islamic society, and the Islamic world, we will witness a change in the new world order for the benefit of humanity, freedom, and Muslims.
In recent years, different geopolitical developments have led to the decline of the West's unipolar hegemony. Iran, as one of the most important actors in the regional and global stage, plays a key role in the new world order.
Last year, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei announced that the world is on the threshold of a new order. This international conference is a testimony that Tehran is not only serious about the issue, but intends to play a major role in creating a new multipolar world order. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Limelight. U.S. regional banks plunge as investors worry the crisis is not over. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Al Jazeera English reported, uncertainty continued to pummel the banking industry, despite assurances from financial regulators and bankers such as Jamie Dimon that the worst of the recent crisis is over and the health of the banking system remains strong. Shares of a smaller regional lender, PacWest Bank, plunged nearly 50% recently, after the company confirmed reports that it was considering strategic options that may include the possible sale of the company. PacWest, based in Los Angeles, said in a statement that it was not experiencing any out-of-the-ordinary deposit withdrawals and still plans on selling off some assets to free up cash on its balance sheet. With $44 billion in assets, PacWest is roughly one-fifth the size of the three regional banks that failed over the past 2 months, including Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and the First Republic Bank. The bank experienced significant deposit outflows after Silicon Valley Bank failed in mid-March, but said deposits have increased since March 31st, including in its venture banking division, which serves technology and startup companies. Still, investors fear that PacWest's fate could mirror that of another California bank, First Republic, which spent weeks looking for a buyer before failing. The regional banks that have run into trouble have seen heavy outflows of deposits and need to raise capital. Nearly all have large amounts of low-interest bonds and commercial real estate assets on their books and would record losses if they sold them on the open market. Healthier banks have been reluctant to step in to buy struggling lenders. All assets of Silicon Valley, Signature, and First Republic were bought after regulators seized these institutions and their remnants were transferred to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. In another sign of potential trouble for the banking industry, a major deal was called off recently. TD Bank Group and First Horizon Corp said they called off a planned merger, citing regulatory hurdles. Toronto Dominion Bank had said in February that it was buying regional bank First Horizon in a $13.4 billion all-cash deal. Western Alliance shares were among the most volatile and were down 39% when trading was halted. The Phoenix-based bank put out a statement overnight saying it has not experienced any unusual withdrawals and its plans to readjust its balance sheet were underway. Recently, the Financial Times reported that the bank was also considering strategic options. The bank strongly denied the report. A bank spokesperson said, "Western Alliance is not exploring a sale, nor has it hired an advisor to explore strategic options." Other regional banks come under selling pressure. Zions Bancorp dropped 10%. Commercial fell 12%, and Kevi Corp fell more than 6%. U.S. officials at the federal and state level are assessing the possibility of market manipulation behind big moves in banking share prices in recent days. Reuters reported recently citing an unnamed source familiar with the matter. The Federal Reserve's fight against inflation has played a key role in the banking turmoil. The Fed recently raised its key interest rate by a quarter point to the highest level in 16 years as part of that campaign, its 10th consecutive rate hike. The higher rates have prompted depositors to move money into higher-paying certificates of deposit and money market funds. They also played a role in the slowdown in the tech industry, which had major implications for West Coast banks such as Silicon Valley. Chair Jerome Powell said the Fed would monitor several factors, including the turmoil in the banking sector, in deciding its next move on rates. The Fed chair stressed his belief that the collapse of three large banks in the past 6 weeks will likely cause other banks to tighten lending, and that would help the Fed in its inflation fight. Powell also said the seizure of First Republic was an important step towards drawing a line under the recent bank stress, but some analysts on Wall Street saw continued turbulence for the industry. Banks have weathered a tumultuous environment for the past 2 months An uncertainty lingers in the smaller regional bank segment, JP Morgan told clients. The firm anticipated bank stocks continuing to be pressured due to regulatory and economic uncertainty, among other factors. It said regulatory concerns primarily would translate into how much banks need to add to capital, liquidity, and debt, all of which would strengthen them longer term but hurt earnings per share. Meanwhile, according to RT, a poll shows that almost half of Americans think money is unsafe in American banks. Conducted a month after two major bank failures, the survey results recall the aftermath of the Lehman Brothers collapse. Nearly half, 48% of Americans, are concerned about the safety of their bank deposits, according to a Gallup poll conducted a month after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank collapsed and published recently. Earlier this week, First Republic Bank became the third major U.S. financial institution to close its doors in 3 months, reigniting fears about the industry's stability. Almost a fifth, 19% of the 1,013 Americans polled said they were very worried about the fate of their finances, while another 29% were moderately worried. The largest percentage were not too worried, 30%, and 20% were completely worry-free. The figures were similar to those reported by Gallup in 2008 following the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the investment bank considered too big to fail, whose demise triggered the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Republicans were more likely to voice concern about the safety of their money, with 55% reporting they were worried, compared to 51% of independents and just 36% of Democrats. These responses appear to reflect individuals' feelings about the party in the White House, asked the same question in 2008, after Lehman Brothers collapsed under the administration of Republican George W. Bush. Republicans were less likely, 34%, to worry than Democrats, 55%, or independents, 44%. Those numbers flipped just 3 months later after Democrat Barack Obama was elected president. Americans making less than $100,000 per year were slightly more likely to worry about whether their money was safe in the bank than those making more, 50% versus 40%, even though wealthier individuals' deposits would be more likely to exceed the $250,000 covered by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Citing these figures and the fact that college-educated respondents were less likely to be worried than those without a degree, Gallup hypothesized that worrying about whether one's bank deposits were safe was due to ignorance of FDIC safety net, though the pollster acknowledged distrust in the government might also be a factor. Nearly 200 American banks face similar risks to SVB and Signature, according to a recent paper from the Social Science Research Network. Former Lehman Brothers VP Lawrence McDonald was more conservative with his estimate of 50 banks poised for collapse, but warned that deposits guarantees would have to be increased to stabilize the sector. U.S. President Joe Biden has insisted there is nothing wrong with the country's banking sector, but promised to extend FDIC protection beyond $250,000 cap if necessary. Thank you.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Everything about football.
I don't think we know Jonas Salk. The name doesn't really ring a bell. Jonas Salk is a person who developed polio vaccine for everyone free of charge. All of us are indebted to him, but we just don't know him. On the other hand, there are many people who may not know Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Or, for example, we don't know the name of the president of Gabon. Actually, most of us don't know anything about Gabon. But we know Aubameyang, the Gabonese football player. This is a rule. Football players are the most famous people. People, even in far-fetched places in the world, love football and they follow everything about football. You only need to be in the first layer of football. Then everyone in the world will fix their eyes on you and everyone in the world will know you. Football is the key to fame. Football is the key to popularity. Fame and popularity will bring power and wealth. This is what subconsciously draws politicians to football.
The 45-year-old is the third richest person in the UK with an estimated fortune of over £10 billion. He bought Chelsea Football Club in 2003 and has the ear of the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who got extremely rich after the collapse of the Soviet Union and about the power struggles in modern Russia.
The name of many politicians in the world are so tightly intertwined with football that people in the world can hardly remember their political designation. For example, not many people remember Roman Abramovich, the owner of the Chelsea Club, was once a member of the Russian parliament, the Duma, or was a governor of a district in Russia. Many people in the world know Silvio Berlusconi, not a powerful former Italian prime minister, but as the owner of AC Milan Club. Many people don't care the current owner of the Manchester City Club is the vice president of the Cabinet of Minister of the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and this is not the entire story. Evo Morales, the former president of Bolivia, played football in friendly and local matches in front of thousands of his supporters and those who voted for him.
Saadi is sort of the black sheep of the Gaddafi family. He tried to enter professional football or soccer in Italy. He played one game for Perugia, but then failed a drug test.
Saadi, Gaddafi's third son, left no stone unturned so he could play in Calcio. And the legendary Fidel Castro loved to spend time with Maradona, a world-class legend of football. Many politicians are directly engaged in the game of football. The story doesn't end here. Political parties and groups love to use the popularity of great football players to achieve power. For example, Kaká Khaled's AC Milan's robust defense was elected as the mayor of Tbilisi. Before that, George Weah, the legendary striker of Milan, became the president of Liberia. Brazil's Romário became a member of parliament in his country. Before that, Hakan Şükür, the renowned Turkish forward, was voted to become a member of parliament. In 2008, when Roman Pavlyuchenko was scoring a goal against Edwin van der Sar like this, he had been voted as a member of the Duma in Russia. Sometimes it's the football players themselves who use people to guarantee that their people's political goals will be fulfilled. For example, Dr. Socrates, with his memorable goals against Russia or Italy, he was a genius who would sometimes wear headbands with political slogans on them. He would also wear shirts with political slogans and would fight the military dictatorship in Brazil like a revolutionary. Or Lillian Thuram, who made interviews in support of immigrants and black people and those who live in shanty towns in France. He had vitriolic words for then French president.
When you're the president of the Republic of France, you can make speeches like Mr. Sarkozy did in Dakar, for example, when he explained that black people had never made a mark on history. It was a racist speech.
Or Didier Drogba, who used his popularity to help stop the civil war in the Ivory Coast. Football and politics are twins. When no politician could ignore a weapon named football, and when insignificant clubs and less famous players can have remarkable political roles and influence, it's only natural that the World Cup turns into a major opportunity for political campaigns. Millions of people are glued to the games for a month. The headlines of all media are about this big event. All cameras in the world are directed towards the World Cup. It's the best opportunity to be seen, to be known, to become popular, and to gain power and influence. That's why most of the great politicians, one way or another, pretend that they're involved with the World Cup. That's why politicians try to direct the World Cup.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
The game of the politicians for the World Cup starts from the time of selecting the host. They meet FIFA officials. They discuss with other heads of states. They deliver speeches and advertise. They spend their money, fame, and credit. Even in some cases, they might spend illegal money to be chosen as the host. Being chosen as a host means economic boosts, increase in popularity, and to a great deal, guaranteeing the political future. It's natural that people in a country are satisfied with the politicians who take the most important event to their country. But what if they're not the host?
Landon, what do we got? Hope you guys caught that. That doesn't happen very often. Okay, and what do we got here? That's good.
Well, in that case, they meet the players and the national team coach as a first stage. Almost all presidents and prime ministers take a sneak peek at the national team preparations before they go for the competitions. They take as many pictures as they can and record videos with famous players and announce their support for the representatives of their country to the world. And now, they have to show themselves in the World Cup. They enter the stadium and sit right next to each other in the VIP stands and show themselves so worried or happy so everyone knows that there is nothing more important for them than their national team. If they can't take part in person, they record a video message.
Man, I just wanted to call and say you guys did us proud.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys captured the hearts and imaginations of the whole country. It's unbelievable.
Well, we heard you were watching, and we know how big a supporter you are, so hopefully we made you proud. It was our honor, as it always is, to represent our country.
All right, appreciate you guys. Safe travels back.
Thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Sometimes they even make controversial interviews about the incidents during the World Cup. For example, after Suarez was dismissed and Uruguay was defeated by Colombia, then-President Jose Mujica took part in the ceremony to commemorate the Uruguayan football star and in an interview branded FIFA officials as a bunch of sons of who defeated his country's team on purpose. It's true, an all-out political show takes place on the sidelines of the World Cup. That's why politicians get extremely happy over their team's ascent to the World Cup. The World Cup gives them plenty of opportunities so they can promote their status or stabilize it, or at least it gives them an opportunity to show themselves to the world.
And the break is on Amiri. Osmoun's sure on goal. Here he can put it around the head. It's Osmoun! Suspended save into Handbash.
The first achievement is getting closer to the citizens. Ordinary people are crazy about football. They love their national team. Victory, pride, and their flag is more important than anything else for them. When the president of a country watches people's favorite team just like them, it can mean that he's part of the people. He has the same interests and obsessions, and he will do anything so their favorite team, namely, the favorite team of his fellow citizens, will win. This public belief is a major point in the minds of voters in the next elections and in the mind of the people in other countries who consider it as a symbol of a nation. Besides all of this, participation of a country in the World Cup and its success during the games will change everything in that country. Public joy and spirit, unity among the people, and even satisfaction with the standard of living. Politicians love the World Cup. They use this opportunity to achieve their goals, and this is one of the reasons of the theory that the World Cup is a political phenomenon. Yes, it's one of the reasons.
It's Jerdan Shaqiri now for Switzerland. Can he win it? Shaqiri scores! What a turnaround from Switzerland! One goal down at the break. They have now scored twice in this second half.
The other reason is politics has always imposed itself on the World Cup throughout history. The competitions have always been a symbolic scene for conflicting political forces. It's a rich political history. the 1934 World Cup was held in Italy. Mussolini, the fascist leader of Italy at the time, would go to the stadium, becoming the champion was so important for Mussolini that he did whatever it took to achieve that. He even invited the referee who would officiate the Italy-Austria match to a private party on the eve of the game. The flamboyant closing ceremony of that edition of the World Cup was held in a completely nationalistic atmosphere. The political tinge was obvious in the next World Cup as well. When the national anthem of Italy was being played, the Italian players hailed like fascists as a military unit. On the other hand, the German team was a combination of German and Austrian players, 7 German players and 4 Austrian players, because the same year, Hitler had managed to annex Austria to German territory. That year, Italy became the champion for a second time. Mussolini achieved everything he wanted from football, nationalistic passion, joy, pride, public excitement, and unity. Later on, in the 1954 World Cup, Bern was a realm of muscle flexing for Germans. Only 9 years after a war that ruined the country, the Germans showcased their indefatigable and fighting spirit. In the strangest final match in history, they defeated Hungary in a dreamlike comeback and revived their national pride that had been trampled upon. Now, the defeated Germany had something to take pride in, a symbol of the uprising of a country that had lost everything it had. In the following World Cups, football turned into a symbol of rivalry between the East and West. The Eastern Bloc countries try to flaunt the orderly structure and teamwork in their societies within their teams as well. For them, football was a battle. It was an arena to prove that their philosophical and political beliefs were correct. In the 1958 World Cup, the Soviet Union defeated Britain, and North Korea became a phenomenon in 1966 and defeated powerful Italy 1-0. Later on, in the playoff match in 1974, the Soviet Union had to play against Chile. The political officials of the Communist Party decided not to play in Chile as a protest. Pinochet, the Western-backed dictator, had just orchestrated a coup, and the Santiago Stadium had turned into the biggest political prison in the world. FIFA announced the result 3-0 in favor of Chile. As ordered by General Pinochet, the Chilean players were in the field and were attacking the Soviets' empty goal. Chile took part in the 1974 World Cup. The confrontation between the East and West reached its climax when the two swaths of the post-war Germany, namely the East and the West, played against each other. Afterwards, politicians came up with the idea of changing the results. There are strange but unconfirmed reports about match fixing in the 1978 World Cup in Argentina. General Jorge Videla, the Argentine dictator back then, and Morales Peros, the Peruvian president, they say the Argentine government forcibly disappeared some of the Peruvian dissidents, exactly the way it would deal with its own dissidents. In return, Peru received 6 goals in a suspicious match and paved the path for Argentina to become champion. The dictator back then needed it to calm the public. In 4 years later, in the 1982 World Cup, fixing the outcome by political authorities did not need any conspiracy. When Kuwait received the fourth goal from France, a Kuwaiti official got into the field and kicked a fuss and threatened that he'd get his team off the field. The fuss yielded a result. The referee disallowed the goal and the raging politician went back to the stands.
The World Cup is beloved across our planet because it offers a chance for people from around the world to be judged not by the place they grew up, the color of their skin, or the way they choose to worship, but by their spirit, skill, and strength.
And finally, one of the most politically charged games in the history of the World Cup, the match between Iran and the U.S.
As we cheer today's game between American and Iranian athletes, I hope it can be another step toward ending the estrangement between our nations.
Let's not forget that the World Cup is not just a sports event. It's part of a political process for politicians to gain power and popularity. Let's not forget that only with a little attention, we could see that the World Cup, with all of the issues that surround it, is a tool in the hands of different governments to push their goals forward. Let's not forget that every minor incident in the World Cup might affect the political fate of millions of people. And the exciting and attractive games of the World Cup can be more than a simple football match. For example, it might be a political battlefield for two countries or two political schools. Let's remember that political powers affect the World Cup, and the World Cup affects political powers. This time, we can view it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime military has recently killed 13 Palestinians in overnight Gaza raids. The airstrikes targeted Islamic Jihad leaders, leaving three commanders killed, along with four children, three women, and a dentist. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard: the Israeli regime military killed 13 Palestinians, including three Palestinian Islamic Jihad commanders, along with their wives and children, in an overnight attack on the Gaza Strip. A total of 40 fighter jets participated in bombing different locations in the besieged enclave just after 2 a.m. local time, according to the Israeli regime military. The Palestinian Health Ministry said four children, four women, and a dentist were among those killed. Another 20 people were wounded, including 3 children and 7 women, some of whom are in serious and critical condition. 3 commanders in the Al-Quds Brigades, the military branch of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, were killed along with their families in the bombardment. They were identified by the PIJ as Jihad Qanam, Al-Quds Brigade's General Secretary, Khalil al-Bahtini, a northern Gaza commander, and Tariq Ezzeddin, a military commander. The Islamic Jihad is considered the second largest armed group in the Gaza Strip behind Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, which governs the enclave. The group said in a statement that a response to the Zionist regime aggression will not take long. The bombardment will be met by the bombardment and the attack will be met by an attack, said Islamic Jihad spokesperson Talegh Salimi, adding, this crime of the Zionist regime will not pass unpunished. Hamas chief is